I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The Rohingya, Muslims living in Bangladesh and Burma, a country also known as Myanmar, have been called the largest stateless people in the world. In Burma, they face persecution and have been denied citizenship and other rights under a 1982 law. Tens of thousands have been forced to live in displacement camps, and the conditions are so harsh that thousands have fled on boats where they've been mistreated by traffickers and smugglers. Nonetheless, they keep taking these dangerous journeys looking for a better life. Today on the show, we talk about the other refugee crisis. It's not on the same scale seen in the Middle East and Europe, but there are some parallels. And joining us is Shashank Bengali, Los Angeles Times South Asia correspondent, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Let me begin with a story you had last week in the paper about a teenage boy, Mohammed Uyaf. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, but he's 16 years old. He's living in one of these displacement camps. How did you get to know him?
Well, Marty, I like many journalists, I've tried to get inside these displacement camps where the Rohingya Muslims live. That in itself is a bit of a process. You have to get permission from the Myanmar authorities, who don't officially recognize the Rohingya as an ethnic group. They've corralled thousands of Rohingya into these camps. Once you get permission to go inside the camp, you can then talk to people. I met this family, Mohammed Ayuf's family, his father, his mother, three brothers who are living in Myanmar, and another who has gone overseas for work. And Mohammed said that from the beginning, when they were forced into this refugee camp 3 years ago due to anti-Muslim violence in their town, he, from the very beginning, wanted a way out. He said there are no jobs there. There's no proper schooling. He used to work in the market where his father had a grocery store that burned to the ground. So he said that for him, the only way he could find a living, to do anything of any value, any worth, was to try to escape Myanmar on one of these very dangerous boat journeys.
And what were the conditions like inside this displacement camp where he and his family live?
Well, the camp is basically, it exists basically because of the work of foreign organizations, the United Nations, the UN Refugee Agency, various international NGOs. The Myanmar government doesn't provide any services inside the camp. And keep in mind that these Rohingya are people whose families have been in Myanmar often, in many cases, for generations. Mohammed's family dates back in Myanmar at least to before World War II. And yet the Myanmar government doesn't view them as legal citizens. They view them as migrants from Bangladesh. And so the government doesn't provide any services. There are the only schools that are in the camp are Islamic madrasas and a very small number of primary schools. There is, there are water and sanitation services provided by NGOs. It's just very, very basic living. People live inside one room, kind of bamboo huts that flood in the monsoon, that get swelteringly hot in the summer. And just it's a very, very desperate situation for a lot of these families.
And what sparked that violence of a couple of years ago, the anti-Muslim violence?
So there's kind of a strain of thought in Myanmar. Now, Myanmar is an overwhelmingly Buddhist country, and there's a strain of thought among some majority Buddhists that these Rohingya are not they're not sort of citizens of Myanmar. So there's a lot of agitation that goes on, particularly by some of the hardline Buddhist monks who preach anti-Muslim rhetoric in monasteries. And in 2012, after many years of such preaching going on in these monasteries, there was a report that one of the women in this area of Western Myanmar, a Buddhist woman, had allegedly been raped by some Rohingya men. Mm. And that sparked very serious anti-Rohingya mob violence in this province of Rakhine in Western Myanmar. And one of the major Muslim enclaves in Rakhine, which is in the state capital of Sitwe, was effectively burned to the ground. There were mobs that came in many cases, according to residents, that mobs were backed by state security forces. and by Buddhist monks as well. And tens of thousands of Rohingya were ordered to leave their homes, and that's how they ended up, many of them in these camps.
Is there any way to know whether this charge or this allegation of rape was true or not?
It's very hard to know, to be honest. There's been a lot of questions about this, and because there's so much confusion surrounding the actual victim, that there are some reports that somebody had been assaulted. There may be some truth to that, but it's been very difficult to pinpoint exactly who carried out this attack. What's clear is that there was a lot of hateful rhetoric building up for many months and years against the Rohingya population. And so it was very easy for a charge like this, whether true or not, to escalate into something that threatened the entire community of Rohingya.
As you write in this article, Mohammed Ayouf, his brother, his Mohammed Fayez, did take one of these dangerous journeys. What happened to him?
So he was among the first wave of Rohingya to leave Western Myanmar after the violence in 2012. Mohammed Fayez is a few years older. He's about 22 years old right now. And he was one of the first to jump on a boat run by human trafficking networks that thrive in this sort of lawless area of the Bay of Bengal between Bangladesh and Myanmar. And basically these networks, they charge migrants and refugees to get on these boats, and they promise that they will get them to Southeast Asia, to the more prosperous economies of Malaysia and Thailand, where many of these men and women hope to find jobs or at least a stable life and some security. Mohammed Fayez jumped on a boat, didn't tell his parents, and about 10 days later was when his parents first heard what happened to him. He had ended up in a Thai prison. His boat reached Thailand, but he was immediately picked up and put into jail. He spent 9 months in a Thai jail until his family could raise the money using various smuggling networks and middlemen who kind of thrive in this trade. The family borrowed a bunch of money to get him out of jail in Thailand. And then rather than coming home, he found another group of traffickers who took him into Malaysia. And he's been working in Malaysia ever since, working in a steel factory and sending some money back home every month to his family.
But as you write in this piece, also working to pay off a debt to the traffickers.
That's right. So the money that his family had to pay both to get him out of jail, and then the money that he owed to the traffickers he had to pay back. A lot of these traffickers demand payment after these migrants reach their destination countries, because a lot of these people don't have money to pay up front. So the traffickers work out some sort of a indentured servitude contract, effectively, where they link up with people on the ground in Thailand or Malaysia who contract them out as workers in various industries, often illegally and under the table because they don't have legal status, refugee status in their new country. They work illegally. They stay in very difficult conditions in Malaysia, often 20, 30 people to a room, and they sort of work in the shadows for 2-3 years often to pay off these debts.
Even though he knew, I guess, what happened to his brother, Mohammed Ayouf decided to do essentially the same thing, what happened to him.
Right. So earlier last year, last spring, which is sort of when these trafficking boats kind of begin to appear along the coastline, that's when Mohammed Ayouf decided that he was going to follow in his brother's footsteps. He had heard the stories, of course, Mohammed Fayez, his brother, would call home about once a month and would admonish his brother, in these phone calls, don't do what I did. It's dangerous. When you get to Malaysia, it's unsafe. He's always in living in fear of being arrested or being kicked out of the country. So he told his brother not to do it. But, as I mentioned, according to Mohammed Ayouf, the conditions he's living in are so desperate. He wasn't a good student. He really only wanted to work. And so he decided he was going to make the trip himself. And so he linked up with some traffickers who kind of are always in search of new customers in these camps because, hundreds, if not thousands, leave every few months. And he was taken out to a boat that was floating off the waters of Myanmar, told that he would get to Malaysia. And this boat was, you know, to hear him tell it, this boat was filled with hundreds of migrants, both from Malaysia, from Myanmar, excuse me, and from Bangladesh. But before the boat could actually set sail for Malaysia, the word came that the government of Malaysia had cracked down on this trafficking trade. You may recall last May, there was briefly in the news stories about mass graves of migrants that were discovered in the Thai-Malaysian border.
Yeah, I remember that.
And a lot of these people in these graves were believed to be Rohingya. And this finally caused, after years of this going on, finally basically forced the governments of Southeast Asia to announce a crackdown on trafficking. So they said that they would not allow any more of these boats to enter their waters, and they began interdicting ships. They began turning ships away, and you had these horrendous stories and pictures of migrants jumping in the water trying to swim to shore because their boats had been ordered not to to reach the shores of Thailand or Malaysia. Before all this happened to the boat that Muhammad Ayoub was on, the traffickers said, "We can't go any further. We're going to take you back to Myanmar, back to shore." And he basically ended up back where he started from, back in the camp. And he's been there for 6 or 8 months now, trying to decide what his next move is going to be.
Well, in about a minute before I have to say goodbye to you, Shashank. But as you mentioned, springtime is when many people consider taking this dangerous journey. Is Muhammad Ayoub thinking of trying again?
Well, he wouldn't tell me this, you know. He wouldn't tell his parents. His parents suspect that he may indeed be trying again. When his brother left, his mom told me that she basically fell ill and she couldn't speak for weeks. She was so just distraught at the thought of losing her eldest son. And she told me that if she fears that her younger son, Muhammad, will try the same thing. He wouldn't say this for a fact, and I think it has become more difficult for these boats to operate given the crackdown I mentioned in Southeast Asia. But the fact is the desperation increases. There were recently elections in Myanmar that brought in a new party in power, but that party, the party of Aung San Suu Kyi, has not really specified what, if anything, they will do to help the plight of the Rohingya. So for these people, for the Rohingya in these camps, they don't necessarily feel that anything is going to change. And so the desperation for them is just increasing day by day.
Well, we will continue our conversation talking about the Rohingya. Shashank Bengali, thank you so much for getting our conversation started.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he's the Los Angeles Times South Asia correspondent. As I said, getting our conversation started, talking about the plight of the Rohingya, the so-called other refugee crisis. We have two guests who will be joining us. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and in this hour of Radio Times, we're talking about what has been referred to as the other refugee crisis, the plight of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, also known as Burma, also in Bangladesh. We just said goodbye to Shashank Bengali, South Asia correspondent for the LA Times. And now we say hello and welcome to David Matheson. He's the senior researcher on Burma in the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. And David Matheson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is David Crockett, and he's a writer, academic, journalist, also Southeast Asia correspondent, Africa editor, Latin America reporter for The Economist. And David Crockett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hello. And just to correct you, my name's Richard Crockett.
You're absolutely right, and it's staring right in my face, and I don't know why I totally screwed up your name.
So I become David Crockett. All two words.
Well, this is America, and sometimes we do really silly things. Richard Crockett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. It is
Hello.
Right in front of me here. Let me talk about what has been referred to as the other refugee crisis involving Muslims. Of course, we're talking here about the Rohingya. And David, if I could start with you, is refugee crisis, is that an appropriate way to think about what's happening?
I think it certainly is, and it's even more bleak when you look at the history over the past 40 years, because the Rohingya have suffered under three separate waves of major refugee exodus. In 1978, there was a major military operation that drove hundreds of thousands of the Rohingya into Bangladesh. And again in 1991, when hundreds of thousands more were sent into Bangladesh and then returned by the Bangladeshis into Burma. And then the third wave over the past 10 years or so, and we've seen quite a dramatic increase in that over the past couple of years, Rohingya from Burma and from Bangladesh, plus a fair amount of Bangladeshi migrant workers, taking this very perilous journey by boat across the Andaman Sea to reach Malaysia, where the Rohingya population is quite sizable. So the persecution of the Rohingya is certainly long-standing, and their compulsion to flee the persecution they face every day in Burma is really behind this third wave of Rohingya refugees.
Richard, we have been focusing largely on Burma, Myanmar. What about the Rohingya or the Rohingya living in Bangladesh? Have they fared any better in that country?
They really haven't.
Well, let me put this to Richard.
Sorry, Richard, up to you.
That's okay. And then, David, I'll go back to you. Richard, go ahead.
No, it's just not much in Bangladesh. And you know, we know that thousands of the Rohingya who have been trying to flee in boats to other parts of Southeast Asia, both last year and beginning again this year, have been trying to escape from Bangladesh to the area around Cox's Bazar, very close to the border with Burma, Myanmar. So they face discrimination as well, deep poverty, a lack of employment prospects. So they fare a little better over that border as well. And the Bangladeshis barely acknowledge the problem, just as the Myanmar and the Burma government don't acknowledge the problem either. I.e., as far as possible, they treat the Rohingya as non-people, non-citizens, with no rights, and try to just forget about them, basically.
And you had a piece, Richard, about in Bangladesh sending Rohingyas to an island, I guess. It seems like a very fragile, unstable island. Can you talk about that?
Well, this was an idea which was mooted last year as one solution. I don't think it's going to go very far, and I'm not sure it's entirely official policy. But that was one idea, was to give the Rohingya their own island off the Bangladesh coast and to put them there. But I think that's a non-starter, really.
And going back to you, David, there were elections last year in Burma, in Myanmar. There is a new government. Aung San Suu Kyi's party won really decisively in many ways. Do you think this in any way would change life for the Rohingya in Burma, Myanmar?
There's certainly some hope amongst the Rohingya that I speak to that an Aung San Suu Kyi government will treat them better. But unfortunately, her stance on the Rohingya is little better than the current government, the one that she's replacing and the one that's been behind a lot of the persecution. And given that in the lead-up to the election a year ago, the Rohingya was stripped of one of the last rights that they had, which was the right to vote. And it's one of those paradoxes of the persecution that the Rohingya have faced, that people that don't have full citizenship, and they certainly have no claim to citizenship now, were actually allowed to vote in a constitutional referendum in 2008 and in the elections of 2010, which ushered in this pseudo-military civilian government. And in fact, there were two Rohingya members of parliament who were stripped of their right along with almost everyone else from their community in the lead-up to the election. So unfortunately, the situation is either just as bleak or in terms of voting rights and access to basic services. The situation is just as bleak for the Rohingya, and that's something that Aung San Suu Kyi's government is going to have to face. So she's inherited a really quite major problem in the West.
And why does the Burmese government, do they see the Rohingya as some kind of threat? I'm looking, I'm going back to you, David.
They voice, the government sees the Rohingya as illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, and they don't acknowledge that the Rohingya have been there for quite some time. I mean, there's a lot of historical disagreement about this, but certainly the Rohingya have been documented for decades. And they see them all as illegal immigrants. And they use this very discriminatory 1982 citizenship law to not grant them full citizenship rights. And as your previous guest pointed out, the rise of this Buddhist ultranationalism over the past 3 years has really ramped up the anti-Rohingya, anti-Muslim invective throughout the country. And so the Rohingya are even more fast as being potential troublemakers as well as being not eligible for citizenship. And it's a claim that's just not borne out by the facts on the ground. I mean, the Rohingya, a lot of them do have claims, valid claims to citizenship. Most of them were born there. And there really isn't a major problem of illegal immigration from Bangladesh. I mean, as Richard pointed out, the situation for them in Bangladesh is just as dire, but it's probably a little bit worse in Burma. So no one in their right minds is actually going to cross the border seeking a better life from Bangladesh into Burma, certainly not with the security presence along the border now.
Well, going back to you, Richard, and it seems that something happened, 3 years ago in 2012 that created these displacement camps and seemed to make life even more difficult for the Rohingya in Myanmar. What happened?
Yes, this is 2012 in the capital of Rakhine State called Sitwe. And there were two episodes then of ethnic cleansing, basically, where the majority Rakhine population, Buddhist Rakhine population, basically cleared the Rohingya out of Sitwe and out of many of the surrounding villages, driving them into refugee camps, where about 140,000 of them remain to this day. The Rohingya, all their houses were burned down. A lot of the mosques were burnt down and gutted. I was there shortly after the second wave of ethnic cleansing, and it was very organized. It was very comprehensive and clearly carefully planned. And evidence that has accumulated since then shows just how well planned this was, with people being bussed in, armed with machetes, etc., to set about the Rohingya. Many were injured. Probably about 100 people were killed during the two bouts of ethnic cleansing. And the idea, and basically what's that done, is to create what I've called an apartheid, where the Rohingya are now completely separated from the Rakhine population. They're not allowed any contact with their old lives and their old homes in the urban centers of Rakhine State. So they are now properly second-class citizens, in the sense that they're cut off from all means of employment. Their children can't go to their old schools. They are not allowed into the local university to be educated. So these are the deprivations that are forcing thousands of them to take the very, very risky option of fleeing in flimsy old fishing boats and trying to start a better life overseas. And this problem is not going to go away until those root problems of the new apartheid are addressed, because basically the Rohingya that are left, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, as long as they are not allowed to live more than a subsistence existence, then they will try and flee, and hundreds more are going to drown as they try to do that. Thousands are going to be turned away from other countries. The refugee crisis will go on. So it's really the root causes in Rakhine State that have to be addressed there. And, you know, in the modern era, this all started in 2012, as I say, with these two bouts of ethnic cleansing in Sitwe and the surrounding villages in Rakhine State.
We are talking about the plight of the Rohingya. It's also, I've heard pronunciation, Rohingya. These are Muslims living in Myanmar, Burma, also living in Bangladesh, have been described as the largest stateless people in the world. Talking with Richard Cockett, he is South Asia Southeast Asia correspondent, also Africa editor, Latin American reporter for The Economist. Also with us, David Matheson, and he's the senior researcher on Burma in the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. And if you want to join our conversation, any questions or comments, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, let me talk to you about this. These are the race and religion protection laws that were passed last year. What were the intent of these laws?
By a relatively new organization called the MABASA, which is the Race and Religion Protection Association. And this is a growing organization led by very senior Buddhist abbots and some quite prominent monks. And their intention is, the way that they describe it to me, is to protect Buddhism from an imagined threat from the outside. And occasionally they will admit that they think that is coming from Muslims and from the Rohingya specifically. But they also target other Muslim minorities throughout the country. And about 2 years ago, this organization started to promote the idea that Buddhists in the country needed four specific laws in order to protect the religion from outside threats. And this includes the interfaith marriage law, the population control law, the religious conversion law, and a monogamy law. And this group presented drafts of these laws to the government, and the government kind of dragged its heels for a while and eventually created their own drafts based on the Mabatha's draft, and the parliament passed them in 2015. And it's important to note, however, that the Mabatha really kind of proclaimed victory, that they had forced the government to do this. But it's really only the monogamy law that is being enforced at the moment. And over the past 2 or 3 months, it seems that most of the people being charged under this new monogamy law, that there doesn't seem to be a religious dimension to it. It actually seems to be people getting back on their cheating spouses. But all four of these laws really represent a very nasty turn in politics in Burma, and they really add an extra dimension to increased vilification of Muslims throughout the country.
To you, Richard, is genocide too strong a word?
Genocide has been used by some organizations, not least for Rohingya. I think that there's a sort of general agreement amongst groups that look at this at the moment that the situation at the moment sort of is on the brink of genocide. And what I mean by that is that a lot of thinking nowadays, academic definitions, treat genocide as a process. It's not a sort of one-off event, it's a process, beginning with the sort of marginalization and discrimination, then building up into harassment and violent attacks before ending in a genocide, as in a sort of a mass killing, mass elimination of a race. In my opinion, that hasn't happened yet, but all the conditions for that to happen, possibly in the future, are there. As I said, we already have a situation of apartheid. We've had bouts of ethnic cleansing. And the Rohingya are very, very vulnerable because they are not citizens of Myanmar. So they have no rights in Myanmar. They have no protection before the law in Myanmar. I mean, that protection, as it's afforded to other ethnic minorities in the country, is pretty poor. I mean, this is still a pretty savage dictatorial government before Aung San Suu Kyi takes over. But the Rohingya really are at the bottom of the pile and having no protection, even on paper. And as I say, they suffer all the other sorts of discrimination in the workplace, in education, in hospital treatment, medical care, et cetera. So, you know, they suffer sort of almost everything up to actual genocide. But of course, the fact is that thousands of them are trying to escape what could be a genocide, and that's why you have the refugee crisis of the Rohingya going to other countries or trying to go to other countries in Southeast Asia. So I think that's where we are at the moment.
I'm curious about, I guess, what has been described, Richard, as anti-Muslim ultra-nationalism that seems to be growing in Burma, coming from some of these Buddhist clerics. What is behind that?
Well, there's a long history to this in Burma. I mean, basically, this comes from the mass immigration of Muslim South Asians to Burma during the colonial period. Rakhine State in western Burma is a good example of this. When the British invaded Burma to begin with in the mid-1820s, the First Anglo-Burmese War, they brought with them in their wake many South Asians, so people from the countries that are now Bangladesh, India, or Pakistan. Many of those peoples came with them from the British Indian Empire into Burma, because Burma basically was annexed to British India. Right. So that meant all the borders between the old kingdoms of Burma and India were now collapsed. And the result was widespread immigration of South Asians, often penniless, poverty-stricken South Asians into Burma, looking for a better life. Because in those days, in the 19th century and 20th century, Burma was a relatively rich colony. It had fantastic mineral resources, fantastic wealth in teak, for instance, oil, gas. So this sucked in a lot of people, a lot of laborers from South Asia, many of whom were Hindus, but many, many more probably were Muslims. And this fueled a lot of resentment amongst indigenous Burmans. So as far back as the 1920s, 1930s, you were getting anti-Muslim riots, anti-Indian riots by ethnic Burmese, indigenous Burmese, stoked up by nationalist monks who resented the influx of a foreign culture and a foreign religion.
Well, you know what, Richard, hold on to that thought only because we are up on a break and we'll get back to our conversation.
Okay.
We are talking about the Rohingya. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the plight of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, also known as Burma, also in Bangladesh, talking about the history of the Rohingya, their current plight, how the election in Myanmar could impact their status, and also how they are being treated in the countries to which they have fled. And joining us, Richard Cockett. He is Southeast Asia correspondent, also Africa editor and Latin American reporter for The Economist. And with us, David Matheson, senior researcher on Burma in the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. I'll read some email comments as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David, I know we had to call you back and get you back on the line here. And I was just talking with Richard, a quick, I guess, history of the Rohingya. To you, David, and I, you know, speaking broadly, I thought this is a crisis that hasn't got the same kind of attention that the refugee crisis in the Middle East and also in Europe has gotten. Does that seem like a missed opportunity when it comes to the press?
I actually think it was fairly well covered back in May and June when it was at its height last year. I mean, there's a lot of media attention on it at the time. I don't think there's as much attention on it at the moment because the departures from Burma and Bangladesh have been much fewer than in the past 2 or 3 years. We've only seen about 2 boats leave back in October. In November, there are estimates that no boats actually left. And I think that's partly a reflection that many people, both in the camps and in Rohingya communities in Burma and Bangladesh, are now fully aware of the risks and that they could end up in one of these death camps on the Thailand-Malaysia border or end up drowning during the journey. But also realize that they may not actually get to their destination in Malaysia because the authorities will send them back. I also think it's a result of arrests and interdiction of a lot of the trafficking networks that have been involved in it. I mean, we saw this spike over the past couple of years of much bigger ships taking larger numbers of people. And I fully expect that this will resume at some point, but for the near future, it probably won't because of the fears that they may not actually reach the destination.
Do you think, and this, obviously if people who want to leave some of these displacement camps are unable to do it, of course it raises the question and puts pressure on trying to improve conditions within the country of Burma or Myanmar. Do you, David, do you think the U.S. can do more to address this issue, this problem?
I think it can certainly do more, but to be fair, it's actually been doing quite a lot behind the scenes already. And a lot of the UN agencies and NGOs working in Sitwe for people in the camps and in the majority of Rohingya areas in Mongdor and Busidang Township, where a million of them live. I mean, we're talking about 130,000 or so in various camps, the majority just outside of Sitwe in this sprawling camp. There are renewed actions on the part of the UN and many NGOs that have had a very frustrating 3 or 4 years in working with these communities under quite horrific conditions. There is a sense that there's a new opportunity to actually alleviate some of the suffering in the camp and to try and seek more rapprochement between the two communities. But it's very, very early days, and there's still a lot of animosity by both communities, both the Rohingya Muslim and the Rakhine Buddhist communities, towards each other. But there is a sense that there is a growing momentum of small, sustainable steps to look at the underdevelopment of the state and the kind of segregation that has fueled the violence. And I think the U.S. really has an important role in encouraging the new government of Aung San Suu Kyi and all the different communities in seeing that as a better long-term solution than abject flight.
David, do you want to weigh in on that Richard, do you want to weigh in on that as well about the kinds of, I guess, what pressures on the new government once it takes power? And I guess the question is, how much power will this new government have in light of the military control of that country?
Well, yes. All eyes will be on the new NLD government, which is supposed to take over probably in March, and then we'll have a new president as well. I mean, I would just caution people not to expect too much. As has been noted, Aung San Suu Kyi herself has been very reluctant to speak up on the Rohingya issue. In fact, she hasn't managed to mention the Rohingya by name yet in her public pronouncements. But also, you know, this is a Burmese prejudice, a Burmese Buddhist prejudice against the Rohingya and against Muslims, and it's shared, in my experience, pretty widely amongst the NLD too, and amongst many of the new NLD legislators. You know, they share a lot of the prejudices of the average Burman. As I've explained, for historical reasons, their prejudices against Muslims and Rohingya. So I'm not expecting any sudden change of heart or sudden change of policy by the new government for that reason alone. But also, there's an institutional, constitutional issue here that the main oppressors of the Rohingya are the local Rakhine people. And their party, what is now the Arakan National Party, they won the last election. They will have very strong local control in Rakhine State, and they will have they deal with the Rohingya on a day-to-day basis, and they will have a lot of control over the conditions which the Rohingya live in, etc. And they are basically very hostile to the Rohingya. So even if by some miracle the central federal government, the new government of the NLD, have some dramatic change of heart and want to suddenly ride to the rescue of the Rohingya or give them more rights or even begin to grant them citizenship, they will be up against the entrenched, long-standing bigotry of the majority of the local population, which will have political control of Rakhine State. So that will make the situation worse. And the Rohingya know this. I mean, they hope that the change of government in Naypyidaw, when the NLD come to power, will change the dynamic of this situation. But they are, you know, very well aware of the politics of this and how little, perhaps, the new government can do if it has to come up against the local Rakhine population, too.
We have an email for Timothy. Says, can you ask your guests what they think about the idea that the Rohingya were used as a scapegoat to rally support for Buddhist monks who are demanding more rights from the military government? It's the idea that they were promised more rights and power in government if they focus their power against those people. David, can I see if you have a response to Timothy's question?
I'm not sure I understand it, that the Rohingya were used by growing ultranationalist forces against.
I guess were used as a scapegoat to rally support for Buddhist monks who were demanding more rights from the military government.
Certainly, they were used as a scapegoat, one of many, because a lot of these ultranationalist Buddhist monks have been vilifying the entire Muslim population, not just the Rohingya, but the Rohingya have served to bolster the popularity in some circles of this organization, the Mabathar, and some of the more outspoken monks. And unfortunately, lots of other people in society have actually been using the Rohingya as a scapegoat because, as Richard said, it's a fairly widespread sentiment within Burma that no one really likes the Rohingya and no one really wants to take up their cause. And I think that's one of the biggest problems. They don't have many allies within the society. And those that they do are often too afraid to actually voice their support for granting the Rohingya the rights that they deserve.
I wonder, I mean, what you're both describing, and David, I'll go back to you, which is that when people are oppressed and their rights are taken away, they can be ripe for radicalization or violence or maybe even terrorism. Is that a possibility?
It's certainly a concern, but, it's shocking to a lot of people in Burma that given the appalling treatment of the Rohingya over the past four decades, that they haven't resorted to violence to fight back. And that's a fairly widespread sentiment that I get when I speak to Rohingya, that the response is, the way that we're treated is disgraceful, but we don't want to resort to violence. We want to actually be recognized as citizens of this country and to live peacefully. And that's something that the ultranationalist Buddhist movements have been raising, is that the Rohingya are this bulwark of the Islamic world coming into to send radical Islam to Burma, and there is absolutely no evidence, thankfully so far, to suggest that that's the case. But it's certainly a possibility that more and more people are voicing inside the country.
Richard, do you want to add to that?
No, I agree entirely with David. I mean, on that point of the lack of it, what's striking amongst the Rohingya is the lack of radicalization and the pacific nature with which they continue to try and live in Burma. And the tragic irony of this situation is that these people, many of whom have been there for decades, or often their families have been there for hundreds of years, they desperately want to be Burmese. They are loyal Burmese. They admire Burma. They want to be Burmese citizens. They are cruelly persecuted instead. Whereas in the West, talking from Britain or France,
yes,
we have the specter of Muslims here, teenage Muslims, who have very nice lives with all the benefits of Western education, welfare states, etc., full citizenship, full rights. And apparently, with very little prompting, they all go off to fight for IS in their thousands. Whereas the Muslims of Burma, who really are persecuted, they so far have not done so, show no sign of wanting to be radicalized or show any other sign of doing out other than what they've been doing for decades and centuries, which is basically to earn a living, pay for their family, pay for food, and not disturb anyone.
Let me ask you, David, and to you, Richard, as well, which is, I think in this country, sometimes you wonder where your fish, your shrimp are coming from. And if we've been talking about the Rohingya, the possibility of a slave trade here, David, should people be cautious about where they get their seafood if it's tied to the slave trade and to the treatment of or mistreatment of the Rohingya?
They certainly should, and they shouldn't just tie it to the Rohingya, because a lot of the Rohingya migrant worker flows or refugees leaving go to work in different industries in Malaysia. Quite often it's construction and on on plantations around Kuala Lumpur and other places. But there's lots of other people from Burma who do get caught up in this vile trade of slave ships, and that recruits, that includes a lot of Rakhine Buddhists and different ethnic minorities and Burmese from Burma. So they should be very concerned about where the sourcing for their seafood's coming from. And it shows that it's not just the Rohingya being persecuted in these industries. It's lots of different people from Burma and Cambodia.
So, Richard, if it says Thailand, you know, from Thailand, should one be careful?
Yes, certainly. And there's been a long-standing campaign to raise consciousness on this issue and to inform consumers in America and Europe. Activists have been very strong on this. You know, and the abuses in the shrimp factories and on board, even worse, the shrimping boats off the Thai coast have been very well documented. And the Thai government has been in deep trouble with the Americans, who rank them very poorly in terms of sort of human trafficking, etc., for precisely this reason. So quite apart from the Rohingya issue, you should be... very skeptical of your sourcing of your prawns and shrimps anyway.
To you, David, and actually to both of you, I guess the destination has been for the Rohingya to Malaysia. Has that been the place, David, where if they make it on these dangerous and rickety boats, that is where they end up?
Indeed, that seems to be the preferred destination of the majority of them. I mean, almost every Rohingya I've spoken to, that's where they want to go, because there has been a long-standing Rohingya community in Malaysia for a couple of decades. And in fact, some of the demographics on the boats that have been leaving over the past year, something that I found quite alarming, was that, you know, several years ago it was mostly young men who were going to find work. And now we're seeing a sizable number of women with children going to join their husbands in Malaysia. But also some of the young girls that I spoke to in May last year who were found on boats off the Thai coast, 13, 14-year-old girls that are being sent by their families to get married in Malaysia, because their prospects for getting married or having any kind of future in these very segregated villages that they come from in Western Burma are very slim. I mean, these heartrending stories of these young girls have never been out of their village area, never been to a school, and their parents are just sending them to Malaysia on these desperate journeys just to find a husband and settle down there, because the future's much better.
Richard, we're almost out of time here. Are the Rohingya, are they designated as refugees?
Well, designated. Well, they are refugees.
Yes. But for instance, the United UNHCR, are they considered refugees?
Well, strictly speaking, they're IDPs, so they're internally displaced persons, because they are displaced within their own country. But, you know, these are just technical terms, and they are refugees. They're fleeing persecution. They're fleeing a war zone, basically.
Well, thank you to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times, helping us understand what's been happening in Southeast Asia. Richard Cockett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he's Southeast Asia correspondent, also Africa editor and Latin American reporter for The Economist. David Matheson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The senior researcher on Burma in the Asia division of Human Rights Watch. And we began our conversation with Shashank Bengali, LA Times Southeast Asia correspondent, talking about the plight of the Rohingya, or the Rohingya. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.